The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2013 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2013. If you have purchased this audio CD, you are free to make multiple copies of it for your own or your school's use. You may not sell copies of this audio or post it on the internet. To find out more about ACCS, or to order additional conference talks, visit our website at accsedu.org. Look for the Conferences tab. Thank you for your support of ACCS.
All right, good morning. My name is John Breckenridge, and I'm here to speak to you this morning on it's kind of a pretentious title, I suppose, a successful administrative structure for an emerging classical Christian school, long and probably too long, but there are some handouts, and my new friend Brad in the back is handing some copies out. If you need one, if you'd raise your hand, that would be just fine. It's my pleasure to be with you this morning here at the ACCS conference. I've been coming for about 10 years. And it's always great to be back in Atlanta. My wife and I and our children are back in Georgia. We're expats living in Portland, Oregon. And been looking forward to speaking on this topic for a number of months. This was the talk that almost wasn't. I just met my new friend Woody. Where's Woody? Where'd Woody go? He left. That's unfortunate. I thought we were closer than that. But anyway, just met a gentleman who works for Chick-fil-A. We actually drove an extra 2 hours on the first day. We drove across country to be here in Atlanta. We're from Savannah, like I said. We'll be going to Savannah after the conference, and then my wife's from Florida. We'll be going down there. But anyway, on the way on the way east across the country, we drove to Boise, which is the closest Chick-fil-A from Portland. It's about 7 hours. And we look forward to it all day long. And anyway, we spent a mortgage there and enjoyed it. But anyway, drove two more days, spent the first night in Salt Lake City, second night in Denver, Colorado, third night in Wichita, Kansas, all to set up a trip to the Rendezvous in Memphis. Thank you. Thank you very much. Unfortunately, we got there on a Monday night when it was closed, and it was poor planning on my part. So then my daughter, my wife, and my other children decided to stay back at the hotel room, but we drove, my daughter, oldest daughter and I, Hannah, we drove around Memphis. First we went to A&R's, and they didn't do dry rub barbecue, and then we went to, we were going to go to Rendezvous, like I said, but we made it to Corky's on Poplar Avenue. It was all right. But it was a torrential downpour, and we were down to one clicker for the van. And the one was broken already, and I got stuck in a rainstorm with my daughter. And so come out of Corky's all satiated and proud and very full and sleepy, and the clicker doesn't work. And so nothing. We couldn't get the car open. Don't have the key because the key broke off that goes in the clicker. So we couldn't get in the car, couldn't do anything, couldn't get it open, we had to call a cab from Corky's and thought, I'm going to have to make the call of shame to Patch Blakey and Tom Spencer to say that they're going to have to mail order us a key to our car in Memphis. We're going to spend several nights and not going to make the conference. But anyway, we're here, got it to work. By the way, if you don't know, somebody was just asking me about culture in Oregon. What's barbecue in Oregon? Does anybody know? It's grilling. Any grilling. Hamburgers, hot dogs, that's barbecue. And so, yes, let us pray. That's right. And so many times in the first several months we were in Oregon, we got really excited. People are going to have us over for barbecue. And you get there and there's coals on the grill and there's frozen hamburgers and hot dogs, and they don't have any idea what brisket is. They don't have any idea what pulled pork is. They don't have any idea what a Boston butt is. They have no idea about any of that. So food has been the toughest thing. Somebody just asked me, how are you doing? You grew up in Savannah. How are you doing living out in Oregon? Isn't it weird out there? And the only thing I can say, I love Oregon. It's different, culturally totally different. Food has been It's unbelievable how much effect food has on you. So we've already been to the Dwarf House. What else are we going to do while we're here? Anyway, we digress. So not here to talk about food. So introductions for myself. I've been at St. Stephen's Academy in Beaverton, Oregon for 5 years. Before that, I was 5 years as the headmaster at Veritas Academy in Savannah, Georgia. Before becoming an administrator at all, I was a school teacher, a history teacher in the public system for another 8 years. I've been involved in classical education in total about 16 years, I think. I counted it up, maybe 17. Actually, George Grant came to my church in Savannah. I think it was the fall of 1996, and my wife was pregnant with our first child at the time, and I had been a school teacher for a couple, 3 years. And at that point, we had made the decision that we wanted something different for our children than what I was seeing put forward where I worked. So anyway, my daughter is a young child. I'm asked to be on the board at our school. For about 18 months, I did that. And then I was mistakenly hired as the headmaster when they didn't have one. And so I didn't know what I was doing. I really didn't know what I was doing. But I was the school's first headmaster. And in spite of myself, God blessed our work, and a lot of great things happened at Veritas. And so it's the only education my children have known. The talk here is not to inspire you to love classical education or love the truth. I assume that the value and the benefit of classical education is not something I need to convince you of. The premise of my talk this morning is that classical Christian schools are the best thing going, but if we are not intentional about the way that we run them, if we are not really clear that we need to be anticipating doing the things and actually doing the things that are going to maximize our potential, we will not reach our potential. And I've tried to think of some analogies. All learning's best understood, I think, through analogy. And so imagine you're a plumber or you're an electrician and you're a self-proprietor, sole proprietor, and you've got more work than you can do. You know, you're killing it. You've got, 75 hours of work every week, and you're trying to decide as a sole proprietor plumber, when do I hire that next guy? What is the tipping point at which I go to the next step and bring on the second plumber or the third plumber or buy that extra truck or whatever it may be? I'm profitable now. I'm doing great now, but I have no life, and I don't see my kids, and I'm working Saturdays until 7. I miss all the baseball games. I don't get a life. And I'm so busy that perhaps my work is slipping, and that's the question that I think many of our schools have to ask themselves, is what is it that is going to be the best for the school in the long term? In my title, I included the word emerging. The term emerging means growing in my thinking here. At St. Stephen's, we're going to open next fall with about 190 students. 5 years ago, we had 84 students. Portland, like Atlanta, I think. By the way, in Oregon, they say Atlanta. And we have forbidden the hard T sound at my school, so they all understand how to say it now. But in Atlanta and many other cities, Portland, the economy has been terrible, starting to emerge. But Portland has had a really rough time, and in spite of the worst recession in our lifetimes, our schools continued to grow every year, and so in many ways we're very thankful for where we are. We've not grown too fast. In 1999 is when the school began. In 1999 we had 3 students. and no administrators, no teachers except a homeschool mom. And I imagine if I asked for a show of hands, many of you would have similar stories. Many of our schools, 240 or so schools in the association, now started like ours did, with you know, a small group, and this is now getting into the outline. In our early days, we were three students, like I said, very passionate group of founders, a couple of families, no facilities. There was no board of directors, no administration. There was a teacher, but she didn't have any training per se. She just was willing to do it. Many of our schools have the many of our schools have the same general thrust and history. The school was able to thrive in this non-structured environment based on energy, based on drive and passion and commitment. As our founders say, the school thrived in spite of itself. And in these early days, it was administration by committee, by consensus. There were no policies written. There was no roadmap. And that lasted for about 5 years. And then over the next several years, the school, until about 2004 or 5, grew to about 50 students. It was at about the 50-student mark that St. Stephen's formed a board, had an administrative committee. And so our visionary chairman, and extremely visionary, you know, every school probably has someone like our former chairman, Michael. He, by sheer force of will, gathered some people together against the odds and built a school, and built it with people that were like-minded and willing to carry weight and get no pay. In 2004 or 5, I don't think we had but one paid teacher. 50 kids and one or two paid teachers. People were just putting their shoulder to the plow and working. And so our chairman and the board that he assembled did some amazing things. But the school that was being run at that time was run without a principal, without an administrator. It was basically a board that was taking up various roles of administration. So we had a board team that handled all the various things that a principal would handle, the finances. So we had somebody on the board that ran the finances of the school, and somebody on the board that ran the curriculum of the school, and somebody on the board that ran the finances, facilities, and on down the list. And at that time, it was appropriate that that be the case. and so in 2005, about the 50, 60 student mark, the school hired a principal for the first time. And over that period of time, what happened was the board delegated to the principal various things. Think about it like as the regulative principle of being a principal. The board, what it doesn't want to do, delegates to the principal. And if it isn't delegated to the principal, it's not done by the principal. And so that's, but the board continued to be an active board and functioned as sort of a super administration of the school, very hands-on. And again, the school continued to prosper. The school continued to grow, but there reaches a point in a school like ours where you have to decide, you know, what happens when that happens. Does anybody know? Imagine someone want to predict what would happen to a board that does what that board was doing. They burn out. That's right. And it's a whole lot. Imagine the school's growing. You don't need three teachers. You need 12 teachers now. And what had happened was you hire that first full-time teacher. The whole board is engaged in the hiring process, interviewing every teacher, admitting every family. And imagine all of you, if you're on boards, leaving your work to be at a family interview at 4 o'clock for a kindergarten family. Can't we hand this off to somebody? Well, that's what happens in 2005 at St. Stephen's. The board says, can't we hand this off to somebody who can do these specific things? So at any rate, the school grows to about 84, 85 students, and I'm offered the job in April of 2008, move out to Oregon, and I did not know at the time. If I had known at the time, I might not have taken the job, but it was only 2 months earlier in the, we're now on, I'll try to remember to go through the outline and tell you where I'm at, but do we grow or not? Does the school grow or not? Do we intentionally grow or not? The school, in February of 2008, the board voted formally. It kind of happened organically or just by natural happenstance, you might say, that the school continued to add a grade every year like most of our schools did in their early days. And in 2008, in February, the board voted to formally become a K-12 school. Here I was taking the job thinking it's your job to go out and build a high school. Well, it was my job, but I didn't know that my pastor, who has a daughter in our high school now, and my present dean of academics were solidly on the other side of not having a high school at the time because it wasn't perceived that we could do it at a very high quality level. It was not a unanimous thing. My old pastor in Savannah took his call. I went to Independent Presbyterian in Savannah, and he took his call as the pastor in 1987, I believe it was, a young buck out of seminary, and the congregation voted, and it was 65-35 in his favor, something like that, 70-30. And his great mentor was J.I. Packer, and he called J.I. Packer and said, what do you think? Dr. Packer should have taken the job, and J.I. Packer said, run as fast as you can to get out of there. And the reality is that if I had known how tenuous it was to build a great school at that time, I might have been much more reluctant to take the job. But God has prospered the work, and we have a very dedicated group of families, a very dedicated board. But the hardest thing in the world is to build a high school. And I don't know if that resonates with any of you or not. Amen. Can we pray? It is extremely hard. And it is extremely hard precisely because you're upping the ante. The quality has to be there. People have choices. And all of you that are elementary teachers know that when your parents drop their kids off, in your school, it's an emotional thing. The little kids, it's emotional. Parents don't have to be convinced. They see what they see, and it's an intrinsic thing. They get it. There's a connection, emotional connection. At the high school level, the logic and rhetoric level, it is the kid coming home and saying, I don't want to go to school there anymore. Or it's the family who doesn't see the value like they did see the value when their kids were 6 and 7 and 8 years old. You have to do more. You have to provide more. You have to re-articulate the vision. So at the end of the day, St. Stephen's did decide formally to pursue a high school, and we're 5 years into that. Our first graduating class was 1, and then 3, and last year 7, and we continue to develop. But, you know, we don't have classes of 20 like we do in the lower school. So, administrative models. I'm not assuming that everybody that does, that everybody should do what we're doing. There are a lot of reasons why schools would choose different models for their own situation. But let me go through a few of these quickly. There's an administrator model. And I'm an administrator, but I'm a headmaster. And administration is, you know, running the operations of a school. But an administrator in this term really denotes someone who is following more or less a script from other people. So you take the administrator model, that's kind of the regulative principal being a principal again. That's the person who is taking a task list and implementing those things. And so that's what we were in our early days, and that's what many schools in their early development, that's what they do. And then you move on to the principal-only model. Many of, if not most of our schools, they may call themselves headmasters, but many times our schools have a principal, a single person, single woman, single man, who operates the school. And they may or may not have full latitude to make decisions or be a part of strategic discussions with the board and that kind of thing. But the gist of it is they're kind of the sole proprietor. They have to beg, borrow, or steal help. They do handle the operational details of the school. There is one neck to choke from the board's perspective, but the problem is there's too much to do. And so, you know, that, you know, everything, think about what's on their plate: hiring, firing, admissions, finances, development, liaisoning with the board, discipline in the school, culture of the school, athletics, parent relations. It all falls on one person. And if you were at the administrators' conference yesterday, I think Doug Wilson had a good point. You know, what is a temptation that people like me and our jobs have? It's to, obviously, we want to relate well to our boards, but the problem that we face is that if we're not careful, we can not be able to control what is perceived about us. And so the principal, where, you know, the principal with an AL here, you know, the individual, he does not have enough bandwidth to be able to get it all done, and yet he's being judged for getting it all done. And so what many schools, as they begin to grow, go to is one of two models. We've chosen, St. Stephen's has chosen, a headmaster and dean model. I'll go through the other basic option, which is a upper and lower school principal. I'll explain why we chose the deans and the headmaster model. But many schools have a headmaster and a lower and upper school principal. Oftentimes, the headmaster also serves as the upper school principal by virtue of the fact that that's where the strategic weight is for energy and investment and hiring and curriculum. That's where all the talk is. So the headmaster has to be involved in that. St. Stephen's has chosen to go to a headmaster and then a student and an academic dean. And we chose to do this basically to have a headmaster and then and we call them principals if you want, a principal for academics and a principal for student life. And we chose that particularly because St. Stephen's, in its strategic vision, is a K-12 school. We don't want split campuses. We don't want 12th graders who don't have any interactions with first graders. So we've chosen to do we call it a 12 to K approach on everything, student life, academics. No, it's not a mistake. 12 to K. Look backwards at what, start with what we want to end up with and look backwards and see what it is that, we want our little ones to become and how we want them to relate to the older kids. We don't ever want the perspective where the older ones are off on an island somewhere. I mean, we want to give the young kids a target to look at and the families something to aspire to have their kids become. So a portrait of a graduate, that kind of thing, is all tied into that. So that's the model we chose. And at this point, I thought it might be appropriate to go through our job descriptions. I think you all have a handout here. These job descriptions were formulated over the course of about a year, and if you look at the first page, headmaster job description, it's true I have the shortest one, but I am responsible at the end of the day for everything that happens in the school. And so it is wholly appropriate that that when the board looks at the dean of academics or the dean of students, that they see my oversight being key to whether or not the school is operating correctly. So I am responsible for the academic leadership of the school, the spiritual leadership of the school, visionary leadership. I'm not quite sure what you might denote from that. It doesn't mean I'm a prophet. It just means I'm involved with the board now. Organizational leadership, operational management. The buck stops with me. And so if you look at the deans and what they do, you imagine a year before or 2 years before, I'm beg, borrowing, and stealing help to get all this done. Chair of the curriculum committee, curriculum implementation, teacher evaluations, faculty meetings. Every Thursday afternoon at 1:40, my academic dean runs the faculty meeting. What a blessing that's been. My academic dean is an amazing, amazing person, and she's been a godsend. So making sure that our graduation requirements are up to snuff, making sure that we have a parental education component to what we're trying to do as a school. So what happens with a lot of our schools is we get so busy trying to get it all done that we forget to invigorate our families. Well, that's one of the dean's, that's one of her mandates, is to make sure that we're in front of our parents, making doubly sure that they know why they have their kids in our 9th and 10th and 11th and 12th grades. Building connections in the community for classical and Christian education, helping me administrate the admissions to our school is another part of the dean, the academic dean, her mandate. So the dean of students, she manages the extracurricular and programmatic quality of the school. So if I were to ask you what you think the challenges are of growing an upper school, think about, you might say, the competition that comes at the upper school level. We can't have a football team, or we don't have a fine arts program that's as good as the public schools, or we don't have, you know, an orchestra, or whatever it may be. We need to do things at a very high quality level, and if we're not going to do them at a high quality level, we wait. It's really simple. You don't do everything you can do. You do the things that you can do well. And so at the end of the day, it's her job to make sure that at the appropriate time, we bite off more things to chew. So this past year, we started a cross-country team. It was great. May have simply been the worst cross-country team in the history of the world. I think my daughter was on the cross-country. This is being recorded, isn't it? My daughter is a lovely young lady, and I love her dearly. Hannah, I do love you. But the reality is it was the first time in the history of the school in 14 years of existence that our kids had something to do outside of the school hours that wasn't a school play or a protocol dinner or a formal dinner or something like that. It was the first extracurricular thing at the high school level where the kids could get together, wear a uniform, have school spirit, that kind of thing. It was a big deal. It was a huge deal for our school. And it was very, very well done. It was very well organized. We had great coaches. My dean of students hired the coaches. It was a husband and wife team who came out of nowhere and ran a great program. And now they're doing a summer running program. And last year it was not nearly as well done as it will be done this year. And so her job is to make sure that at the appropriate time we pull the trigger on the next great thing. As our numbers grow and as things progress, we'll do more. Oversees the student council, she does. Make sure that everything that we do is well organized, gets on the calendar. You know, be surprised how many little things like your kid coming home and saying, I have something to do tonight at school, and the parents don't know what a big deal that is if it doesn't get done well, you know, like parents being surprised. It's her job to make sure parents aren't surprised. It's her job to make sure that events are happening, and when any event that's happening at the school is done well, anything involving student life and student involvement. So one thing that's not on the outline, and I just met Bruce Williams here a minute ago, but St. Stephen's is blessed with an amazingly competent and gifted administrator. We filled another role, and I know you're probably making dollar computations in your head saying, well, how in the world are they pulling this off with 190 kids? I'll explain that in a minute. But we have an administrator, too. So I'm not a detail guy, and I've said there's only one thing about me that I think is exceptional, and that is that I don't quit. I just keep going. And so get popped in the mouth, I get right back up. And I'm kind of tenacious in that way. But the bottom line is that people like me need someone like Cameron, my administrator, who makes me look a whole lot more competent than I really am. And so she provides all the assistance I need to do that. And she effectively handles the daily details of administrating the school. If you're going to be a headmaster, liaisoning with a board and building relationships and looking at the academic quality of the school and trying to build a school, in our case, we want to be a 400-student school in 7-8 years from now. And we happen to be in a community where that can be pulled off. We're in Beaverton, Oregon, which is 10 miles west of downtown. You put a dot in the middle of our school, and you go out in a radius, circumference, 12 miles around, there's 1,250,000 people within 12 miles of our school. So we're a large market. In Savannah, you do the same thing where I was, and there's 400,000 people. And so we have a large pool to draw from, and we're convinced that we can do that. We never get there without the details being handled. So St. Stephen's has hired an administrator who handles everything from scheduling to the calendar to making sure that when a visitor comes on site that they're not waiting in the lobby for 15 minutes while somebody gets free. I mean, all that stuff is very, very well handled. And then the last thing I'll mention here is that we have a business manager. And all of you that are on boards at your schools, how nice would it be to be able to actually review the finances as opposed to coming up with the budgets for your schools? Or in the past year, the school transitioned, the business manager and I basically over the course of about 2 months formulate a budget that the board ratifies. It used to be that the finance chairman and the chairman and I would show up and we'd go sit in people's living rooms for several weeks at a time and several nights over a few weeks and come up with a budget. And then it'd go back because there was all these changes and the board would have to ratify a budget over several months and it burns all the energy of the board to do that. We have a business manager now. In 1 year we pulled off these four things. Administrator, deans, and a business manager. And the business manager handles all aspects of billing and receivables and payables and everything. And so I am accountable for all four of these people to come forward, supply me with the information I need to be credible with the board and to be able to give them what they need. And so the board can now focus on strategic things. So if you could then turn to the org charts that we put in your hands. If you look at the 2008-09 org chart that is before you, that is what was. And I'll explain a few things. If you go back to what does the principal do, the principal at that time, my job was to run the school and all those things. Still had to do the business side of things, still had to manage student life, still had to guarantee the academic quality of the school, had to come up with everything. I mean, I can't even come up with a list of things. It would take me the next 25 minutes and 54 seconds I have to come up with the things I had to do by myself. And from the schedule, which would might, you know, the schedule's getting done 8 days before school's out. Teachers have been asking for the schedule for, when have any of you got your schedules yet? One teacher in the back. Two. Okay. Well, Mrs. Six, my administrator, is working on the schedule right now. If I was the guy in 2008, I was the guy in 2008 making the schedule. I'm not getting to that till August 15, August 22, somewhere in there. We start school the day after Labor Day in Oregon. That is a good thing about Oregon. Start school after Labor Day. Y'all still starting early August? Oh, unfortunate. Anyway, if you'll look at the org chart, you'll look out to the right, and St. Stephen's had a standing curriculum committee and a standing facilities committee. The board did. And those committees did not go through the principal. And so there was this dual reporting thing going on. And so there were... As Mr. Wilson said yesterday, you know, you can't serve two masters. And so one of the things that I realized, the bookkeeper, there was a bookkeeper, but she reported directly to the board, and the facilities committee reported directly to the board, and the curriculum committee reported directly to the board. And so in my first year, I had to ask for permission to be a part of the curriculum committee. But I'm running the school. Theoretically, and so it was convoluted and it was confusing, and the school was not built at the time to operate with a single person responsible for everything, and it caused some confusion. Like who did the teachers report to? You know, that was a struggle, and nevertheless, the principal at the time. The job description said that the principal was responsible for everything. If you fast forward over to the next page, all that's happened, I mean, there aren't that many new things happening in the school, but now there is somebody responsible for the whole of the operations of the school. The headmaster is, I am responsible for all administration, all academics, all student life, and still overseeing the evaluations of teachers and so forth. But now, if you look, I've got a dean of academics who also, she does half the evaluations on the faculty. We sit down and collaborate on sharing that. And now we can do more evaluations. Our policies say that every teacher needs to be evaluated twice. I mean, once. We're trying to do twice now. The curriculum committee used to be a body that kind of operated outside the daily operations of the school. It was seen as something that the teachers didn't quite understand. Now we've brought in teachers into the curriculum committee, tripled its size. It operates in the daily life of the school. Everything that's all caps is a real person, by the way. So if you look at administrator, that's a person. Acting headmaster when off-site, that's a person. Academic advisor, all caps, all these all cap things are real people. So we have lead teachers that work under the dean of academics. Have a facilities coordinator. The only people that report directly to me are the people where it go directly to me. So I'm not dealing with if the administrative assistant, Cameron's assistant, the administrator's assistant, when she's sick, she's not calling me. She's calling Mrs. Six, for example. It allows me to focus on things that I need to focus on. But ultimately, what this has done for us is it has allowed us as a school to build the structure that's going to be necessary to get to two classes per grade is a huge investment of time and energy and people, resources, and finances. But it's allowed us to become, at 190 students, the school that can fill out to be 350 or 400 students. In the following year, this coming year, we're gonna do status quo and graduate our fourth graduating class. But after that, in the 14-15 school year, my oldest daughter's senior year, we anticipate adding two extra classes in our elementary in our grammar school. Probably our second and third grade, and then an afternoon kindergarten. We have a half-day kindergarten. So in the 14-15 school year, we anticipate basically only needing to hire three teachers, and we have the support in place to be able to do that. And as a result, we're able to plan for that now. If I was a standalone guy at the moment, I'd be having a nervous breakdown. But I think we can reasonably plan for that day. And so over the next 4 to 5 years, the hope is that we'll go from about 120 grammar students to about 200 grammar students, maybe a little bit more. And that will provide the feeder for our upper school. And I don't want to prejudge anybody's work, but at least for us, what we've found is that we can't fill enough. We have more demand than we have room in our grammar school. We have turned away 15 families this spring. We just don't have the capacity, so we've got to go out and find facilities. So what I'm doing, someone might ask, well, what do you do, John, if all these other people are doing this stuff? It's a fair question. What I am doing is anticipating the future needs of the school with the board. And finally, at this stage in my career, I'm able to sit down with the board that I work for and focus on securing the 100-year school. I mean, what's the point of doing what we do unless we're going to be here a generation or three or four from now? And so many of our schools, that's why I was saying I don't want to prejudge you, but the schools I'm familiar with, many of them have our model, which is basically a thriving grammar school, a lot of commitment there, and then it begins to wane over time. And so you might go something like this. You know, 18 to 20 fourth graders turns into 11 or 12 eighth graders, turns into 5 or 6 11th graders. And if you have something like that, that's not atypical. When we went through the accreditation process last February, 18 months ago, David Goodwin, who's the headmaster at the Ambrose School in Boise, sat down with me and asked me, how much do you charge for tuition? And I thought it was a strange question because he'd seen all the material, and I said, why do you ask? He says, well, I'm just curious. And his rhetorical point was, what do your families perceive the value of a, and he was asking the high school tuition, what do your families perceive the value of your high school education to be? And it led to a conversation where he explained to me that that they've had to go to a business model. And I know in our schools we want to be all philosophy and very little business talk, but we need both. We're going to follow pretty much the same business model that the Ambrose School in Boise is following, and that is try to turn 36 elementary kids into 25 seniors. That's the goal. That gets us to 400-ish kids, and that allows us, when four kids decide to leave in after their eighth grade year to become tuba players or football players at the local school, it doesn't seem like we're hemorrhaging to death. It doesn't, and at some point, you know and I know that it's okay if certain people leave your school. It's not a tragedy, but it is a tragedy if there's only eight kids in the class and four are leaving, and the other four are saying, is there going to be anybody left to go to recess with or eat lunch with? And so what we have to do is insulate ourselves against that so we can make a multi-generational impact in our community. And so for us, the model is to try to become a school that endures for generations. Where I'm from in Savannah, everything's old. And in Portland, nothing's old. You know, the oldest building in our town is 50 years old, really. And, you know, schools just you know, and frankly, right now we're in a very good financial situation. We have a paid for building, but it's only meant to last 20 years. We've got to go out in the next 5-6 years and secure our facility that's going to be in existence for the next 100 or 200 or whatever. And as we do that, we'll never get there unless we are prepared to anticipate the challenges that are going to come year by year by year. And that's why we have gone to this structure. A couple questions, and then I'll let you ask questions. If you think that you might be asking yourself, why would I change at my school if things are going well? Well, let me ask you a question if that's what you're thinking. If X happened, what would your school do? Could you take, in our case, we're trying to self-insure. And it's not, I believe in the providence of God like you do. And I believe that that nothing can replace God's kindnesses in our lives and in our schools. But, you know, we also want to put away some stores for the future as well. And I've got a second grader next fall. I want him to be able to have a classical Christian education. And some schools like ours don't make it. And they don't make it because we don't prepare for the future. And so your question I would ask you to think about is, what can your school do to meet its fullest potential? And if I thought about this last night, if I were to come up with a list of places that don't even have classical schools, major cities, my wife's hometown of Jacksonville, Florida, does not have a classical school. Charleston, South Carolina, as far as I know, doesn't have a classical school. Just started. Well, praise the Lord for that. There are a lot of them. I mean, keep going. But there are only 240 schools in our association. So there are whole states that don't have them. I was reading Alaska and Nebraska and a bunch of other places. Point is, we can be more influential than we are. Does anybody know the average size enrollment of a classical school in the association? 144, and that includes schools like Cary. They've got 850 kids and the Regents and whatnot. And it's not all about enrollment. It's not about enrollment at all. But if you looked at the profile of our schools, I think one thing that is true is you have that diminishing curve. Now, maybe that's okay. But for us, we want to add value to what we're doing. And you know, we want the same quality all the way through. But I've often said to our families, we will only thrive. Why do we hire a student dean? Let me throw that rhetorical question out there. We hire a student dean because we want our families to perceive that we care about the student's experience in the school beyond academics. It matters. It doesn't mean we have to be an athletically driven school. We're not going to be an athletically driven school. It's not our forte. We'll do athletics, but they'll be in balance. But if students don't perceive, we're starting a house system, for example. If students don't perceive this is a place where St. Stephen's is a place where they can make great friends, they won't want to go to our school. If they don't perceive that our faculty and our families care about what they are going to do outside of academics at St. Stephen's, then they won't want to be there. They'll be somewhere else. And so we've taken a very intentional approach to that. So let's see. Other than fostering growth, another question I might ask is, why would we make such sweeping changes to our school? Like I said, the one thing I just said, we want to add value to what we do. We want to be perceived rightly as a school that's trying to do all things well, all things that it should be doing well. We want to academically be excellent, spiritual life, Christian formation, we want to be excellent. We want to be excellent in every area that we're called to be. And I'll say two reasons. I'll skip. That's it. So, at that point, I'll open for questions. Yes, sir.
How do you pay for almost a dozen people that are in support
role? Well, the lead teachers, I'll go around the room here on the chart, that is, administrator, we changed her title and gave her some, she was already on staff. She was effectively the school secretary, marketing director, a bunch of different things, and we changed her title and pulled some things from her and hired a assistant for her. That was not a gigantic investment of funds. The acting headmaster is a stipend. It's, you know, I'm not gone that much. It's a small amount of time and money. Academic
advisor.
Acting headmaster doesn't do anything while I'm on site. If I'm at a conference like right now, this is October, he's fielding calls from parents, or if the school burns down, he's the first contact, that kind of thing.
Somebody already on staff?
Yeah, it's one of our teachers. Yeah. So the acting headmaster is basically my fill-in only when necessary. Academic advisor is a very part-time position, about 7-8 hours a week for us. Business manager is a 3/5 position. And the point is, how do we pay for it? We pay for it as the numbers grow. They're making some calculated risks too. All of these positions, the business manager's not handling the business operations of a 400 student school. Our business manager's doing that for a 190 student school. When it's a 400 student school and there's not 105 families to receive tuition from, but there's 220 families, then, you know, that hourly requirement per week is going to go up significantly. Our facilities coordinator is a very part-time position. That's the individual that gentleman unlocks and locks the facility in the afternoon, helps the kids make sure they put the flag up, take the flag down, that kind of deal. Sets up the lunchroom on Mondays, takes it down on Fridays. Parent-teacher fellowship is obviously a volunteer thing. The dean of academics and the dean of students are both presently part-time roles allotted per for the dean of academics, it's 20 hours a week, and for the dean of students, it's 10 hours a week. And so as the school grows, I anticipate the dean of academics becoming a full-time position. She is a teacher in addition. And at some point, she won't teach anymore. And the dean of students is also a part-time position. And at some point, she'll have to decide whether she wants to continue to teach math and be the dean of students or hand over the dean of students position to someone else full-time. Yes, sir.
So what's your total full-time equivalence now?
Oh, in administration, 7, I'd say. Yes, sir.
I didn't hear that question, but what is...
What was the full-time equivalence? That was the question. 7.
So what is the percentage of your entire compensation is delivered to the administrative staff?
The last time I calculated it was probably about 28-29%. But when we're twice the size... The gentleman's question was, what's the percentage of our budget that goes to administration? When we're 25%, 30%, 50% bigger, whatever, and on up, that number is not going to appreciably, it will not grow relative to the total very much. Yes, ma'am.
I do hiring.
The way our system works, I do basically what Tom Garfield does at Logos. I effectively hire and fire, but the way it works is I bring the last candidate to the board, and my preferred candidate, and that individual will have, it's not really, I guess it's an interview, but it's more or less a confirmation kind of thing. The board certainly can veto a hiring decision of mine, but at the time that it gets to the board, by the time it gets to the board, the dean of academics and several teachers perhaps have been a part of a hiring committee. I sit down and interview with teachers, interview candidates, and I don't ever anticipate taking somebody to the board that isn't going to pass muster. That's not a good thing for a headmaster to do. Yes, sir. Yeah, I'm sorry if I didn't. What David Goodwin asked me is, what do your parents perceive the value of a high school education to be? And the reason he was asking that question is because they ran into the same thing. I don't know how much you know about the Ambrose School. It's a great school. They do a great job. And they have, in 2004, I think the numbers were that they were about what we are today. They went to the two classes per grade model, and that's what we're going to do, as like I said. And the reason he asked that question was because his thesis was that particularly the parents at that age, kids are in seventh, eighth grade, unless the parents are perceiving that there's something more than talk of the trivium and whatnot, they're just not going to stick around. And the things that hooked the kids when the parents had kindergartner and a third grader, those things, it's at that point they've got to have something to talk to their kids about beyond you learned logic and now get ready because here comes the rhetoric. All that's true, and not minimizing the wonderful education that our kids are getting, but all you gentlemen in the room, not to say that the ladies aren't athletes, but how many of you can remember, like I can, being in school, it's Tuesday, and you got a baseball game at 4 o'clock. And you're sitting through Algebra 2 class, and it's exciting and whatnot, but you can't wait till 4 o'clock and your buddies at lunch are talking about the baseball game and you're going to whoop up on the other team. Well, you've got to have something like that for the guys and the gals to look forward to beyond just, the great academics that they're also getting. And so, David Goodwin's point to me was that, let's say the boy comes home one day, the son comes home, talks to dad, I want to go over to Smith High School because, they got an electron microscope over there. Well, he doesn't really want to go get the electron microscope. He wants to go somewhere where there's something going on besides sitting in class with the same 9 kids. And you've got, here's something we did this year that was earth-shattering for us, and we had never thought about it. Our kids now move in 7th to 12th grade. They now move from classroom to classroom. For the entire history of the school, the first 13 years of the school, the kids sat in one room all day long, and the teachers moved. Just having kids moving from seven periods a day was a gigantic cultural shift for kids leaving sixth grade. Now they got a schedule, and they got to follow the schedule and move from room to room. It's awesome. It was wonderful. It was big for them. It's exciting. They don't sit in a room and have the teachers come in, and it's, the fourth period in the same room. And they saw that teacher 2 periods ago, and the only time they get to leave the room is go eat lunch or go take a bathroom break. Things like that you got to think about. Yes, sir. Great question. The question is, what percentage of our tuition comes from percentage of our budget comes from tuition, and. And does Evergreen, our church, which I neglected to mention, Evergreen, our board is under the oversight of the St. Stephen, of the Evergreen Session, Evergreen Presbyterians, PCA Church in Beaverton. Our present tuition ratio to expense is 94%. So we do very well. And that's because we don't carry any debt. We don't have any facility debt. And Evergreen, the church, does not support us at all. We're a self-sufficient ministry of the church. Yes, ma'am.
Can you tell me, as a lead teacher, how much more do they get paid? What is their job?
They get a stipend. The the lead teacher for the upper school is also the dean of academics. I failed to mention that. That will not always be the case. So she doesn't receive any additional compensation. That presently is part of her job description. The lower school lead teacher gets about a 15% bump in her pay.
Oh,
her job is to, she's not an evaluator of other teachers, but she is a support to the other teachers. She functions, we have 10 or so grammar teachers, full and part-time, and she's more like shepherd leader, kind of meeting coordinator struggles. She sits down and talks with them. They'll invite her in, hey, I want to teach this lesson, tell me what you think. Curriculum implementation. She runs the lower school meetings. Our faculty meets once a month as a full faculty on a work day, and then they have weekly lower and upper school meetings. I don't know how many of you can relate to this, but they're really two different faculties in many ways. So says I'm out of time. I'll take one more question. Yes, sir. I'll take two more questions. Yes. Go ahead. Go ahead. We have one of those $1 rent. We own the building, and we let them use the facility that we have. They use that facility as well. So we rent the land from them for a dollar, and then they rent the rooms for us for a dollar. They own the land. We own the building. And so it's really a symbiotic kind of thing. Yes, sir. Last question. I'm sorry? Pull off the... that's just the upper school faculty, and that's they have a choir class the whole upper school's at, and all the rest of the faculty, upper school faculty, comes into a room during that time. I'll be up front if you want to come up and ask more questions. Thank you. Extra handouts.